May it please the court, my name is Brynn Cruz, registration number 41572. I'm a deputy state public defender. I represent Ms. Lisa Hart in this matter. Although we only have a short time today together to discuss this case, I do intend to address each of the first three issues raised in the opening brief. But as this court knows from reading the briefs, those issues are pretty interrelated. It's pretty difficult to talk about one without talking about the next anyway. And I do intend to reserve some of my time for rebuttal. Under the United States and Colorado constitutions, if the state was going to convict Ms. Hart and strip her of her liberty, Ms. Hart is first entitled to a fair trial by an impartial jury that would render its verdict based solely on properly admitted evidence, which Ms. Hart would have an opportunity to confront, which must amount to proof beyond a reasonable doubt as to every element of the crimes charged, which in this case is a lawful possession of a controlled substance. What Ms. Hart got instead was a trial where the state was permitted to obtain two drug possession convictions by merely presenting inadmissible hearsay evidence that an officer searched the internet, and the internet told him that the pills found in Ms. Hart's pockets looked like controlled substances, oxycodone and alprazolam, which Ms. Hart was effectively prevented from confronting, and which the state unfairly dressed up as expert testimony to mask its unreliability. Today I submit to this court that Ms. Hart's convictions must be vacated because the evidence was insufficient to support them. And if this court does not vacate her convictions, we respectfully ask that this court grant Ms. Hart a new trial because her state and federal constitutional rights to confrontation and the right to a fair trial by an impartial jury were violated, and the state cannot prove that these violations were harmless, let alone harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
Ms. Cruz, I want to try to focus the argument a little bit.
Sure.
You mentioned the right to confrontation, but isn't it clear that the information from the drugs.com website is not testimonial evidence and therefore doesn't implicate the confrontation clause?
Thank you for bringing that up. I did want to address that. What I think the issue here is really the end run around confrontation that we had in this case. Typically, in a drug case, in order to conclusively identify what is the substance, the state, pursuant to all the statutes regarding chemical testing and lab reports and their admissibility, would submit that evidence to be tested. That the United States Supreme Court and Arnold Supreme Court has held to be clearly testimonial of those lab reports, and the defendant has a right to call that technician into court and cross-examine them and confront them in court about their findings. But the state was able to defeat Ms. Hart's confrontation rights by not pursuing chemical analysis of the test, not pursuing any expert analysis. And so we were effectively left with no one to confront about this key evidence against Ms. Hart at trial. The officer testified that he didn't know when he looked at these pills whether they were controlled substances or aspirin. He had his specialized training and experience, but it didn't appear to extend very far beyond using the internet to do these searches. We had no one there that we could question about this very important evidence. Had there been a pharmacist or forensic chemist, that person is someone that we can question and we can ask them in particular, what about imitation and counterfeit controlled substances? Are these markings really as unique as this officer said they were? Someone who is in a position to answer our questions so that we can fairly present our defense to the jury. And the state was able to, as I said, do an end run around those rights in this case.
Well, I guess my concern is that you can say that about almost any hearsay evidence, but not all hearsay evidence is testimonial within the meaning of the Confrontation Clause. So I'm trying to focus on the hearsay issue. Let's focus on that, okay?
Well, I'm happy to do that. I do just want to back up to the state confrontation issue. That's something I really wanted to address today because my opponent argues that that issue is not preserved, and it's my position that it absolutely is. Now, counsel said confrontation. She didn't say state confrontation, but the trial court was alerted to this issue and did, in fact, apply the state constitutional test and entered findings under that test. As the Attorney General acknowledges in his brief, there is no federal constitutional issue for non-testimonial hearsay. And so when the court is going through and applying the Roberts test, that is what he's doing, is applying state constitutional tests. The court's presumed to know what the law is And I think it would be unreasonable to assume that he is applying now with validated United States Supreme Court precedent. So the state confrontation clause issue is preserved in this case. And to just kind of sum up on the question you asked, the confrontation is really the harm of this hearsay issue because we really had no one that we can confront about this evidence. It was merely what the internet had told this officer. So let me now address that hearsay issue. Testimony that the officer consulted the internet and the internet told him that these pills looked like controlled substances is hearsay, and it's inadmissible because it does not fit in any exception, no matter how hard the state tries to force fit it, particularly in this market reports exception. We know this to be true because the market reports exception, the plain language of the rule, states that it applies just to market reports, market quotations, market tabulations, market lists. That word market clearly modifies all of those terms that follow it. And not just any document pertaining to, you know, market values and market information, but it has to also be a market document that people rely on for their very livelihoods. So some cases say, you know, your internal price list that's not promulgated to anybody, that's not something that people generally rely on. And the state has attempted to divorce the language of the rule from its context, from other language within the rule itself, kind of parse out these things so that any list, any directory, whether market related or not, as long as someone comes into court and says, I rely on that, then it would be admissible as a market report. And I think that would produce some pretty absurd results. That's a very broad reading of the statute that is not justified by the plain language, nor the history of this rule. It's a very old rule. It was very narrowly developed over time. It really is for proving basically market value. If you look at all the cases where this evidence is admissible, it's almost universally to prove market value, which is sort of a subjective idea of, you know, what does the market say this thing is worth? So it's almost exclusively used to prove damages, the value of property taken, things like that. Here is something much different. We have, it's an objective fact. Is this pill, does it contain a controlled substance or doesn't it? There will not be any sort of subjective ideas, you know, what's the market bear, what would I really pay? That's what market reports is for, because that's really set by the industry and it's dependent on, you know, people ensuring its reliability because they stake their financial well-being on it. We really have nothing like that in this case. You know, if we had, and the Attorney General says, well, you know, pharmaceutical drugs, they can be sort of traded in commerce. Well, that might be the case, but that's not what drugs.com is about. Drugs.com is not a resource to find out, you know, what's the market value of these prescription drugs. You know, there's like perhaps closer to the consumer price index. You know, that actually tracks the price of consumer drugs. If we were talking about admitting, you know, the consumer price index, sure, that sounds like a market report. People certainly rely on that. Or Pfizer had a list of what its prescription drugs cost, and that its pharmaceutical sales reps rely on. You know, I think we might have a market report in that case. We're clearly so far afield with this evidence here. It simply does not fit into this rule.
Ms. Cruz, let me ask you this. If we were to disagree with you, and if we were to conclude that this evidence does fall within the parameters of Rule 803, what other factors, if any, would we be looking at to determine whether this evidence is admissible?
Well, if I understand the court's question correctly, I mean, I think one of the factors you could consider under that analysis, so you're saying that this evidence would be admissible.
Let's say it's included within market reports and other commercial publications. That this evidence from drugs.com is a market report, or it is a commercial publication, or it is one of the types of evidence covered by 803. Mm-hmm. If it is covered by 803, is there any criteria or other factors that we need to look at to determine whether or not it's admissible?
Well, I think, you know, as the initial question of admissibility, you apply the formula set forth in the rule itself. And so you would have to, you know, determine that this is related to markets and that this is generally relied on. I think we have a problem here where the law enforcement is the one laying the foundation and sort of ensuring the reliability and admissibility of its own evidence. But once that is admissible under the rule, I think that's it for the hearsay. And I'm concerned because it still leaves the confrontation problem. You know, one thing that's analogous would be like the physician's desk reference. That's held to be admissible even though it's hearsay. But significantly, that's considered a learned treatise. And so if they want to bring in evidence of the physician's desk reference, they must present that through an expert. That's what 803.18, the learned treatise exception, says. So that evidence would be presented through an expert, and boy, is that a lot better than what we have in this case, because then you would have a chemist or a pharmacist be coming in to talk to us about visual identification of pills, whether that's a reliable thing or way, you know, is that always accurate? Does that really tell us what this in fact is as opposed to what it appears to be? How prevalent are counterfeit controlled substances? You know, then we could actually have something we could confront. Once this becomes admissible under a market report, an annual person, any old witness can come in and just tell us what the internet told him, well, we really don't have anyone to confirm. So, you know, to answer your question, there's probably not much more as to the hearsay issue that would need to be discussed. I, however, do not believe that even if this evidence were admissible under that exception, it would constitute sufficient and substantial evidence to support the conviction, because all this evidence tells us is what these things appear to be. They don't tell us what they really are. That's a very critical thing in this case, because if this pill contains no controlled substance whatsoever, it's a complete fake, it's a sugar pill, it's a placebo, it's a counterfeit, well, that's not a crime to possess. There is no crime for mere possession of an imitation counterfeit controlled substance. Now, on the other hand, if we test this pill and it turns out it contains a controlled substance, well, we need to know exactly what that controlled substance is, because not only are we determining crime versus no crime, but we're determining the level of offense. If it's Schedule 4, it's a misdemeanor. If it's Schedule 3, 2, or 1, then we're talking about felony offenses. In this case, we have absolutely no idea what those pills were. We're not sure if, in fact, this is nothing. Maybe it's a misdemeanor because it only contains a Schedule 4. We really don't know because there's no chemical test. And as you know from my briefs, I argue that in the case of prescription drugs, I think we have a unique set of circumstances just because, as other courts have recognized, and I cited those cases in my brief, there is a real epidemic of imitation controlled substances, things that look identical to what they appear to be. And our statutes define the offenses very specifically in very specific scientific terms. And they have all these requirements and rules about admissibility of lab reports. That says to me that the legislature intended for there to be a chemical test so that we can properly enforce the criminal code. We don't know what crime, if any, has occurred in this case unless we test the pill itself. And that is what the Supreme Court of North Carolina has decided, that a chemical test is required. And in fact, they said...
I'll remind you, you have a minute and a half left. You said you wanted to reserve some time.
And if there aren't any more questions, I think I will reserve the remainder of my time, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ethan Zwang, registration number 44794, and I'm here today on behalf of the people. The information from drugs.com was properly admitted under CRE 803.17. Under that rule, the basis for trustworthiness is general reliance by the public or by a particular segment of it, and the motivation of the compiler to foster reliance through accuracy. Here, Trooper Hansi testified that his office regularly uses drugs.com. As the trial court noted, scores of judicial opinions rely on the information from drugs.com.
Counsel, can you cite me a case where any court has relied on drugs.com to identify a drug? I couldn't find one.
I don't know if there is a case that uses to identify a drug, but in this case, drugs.com was not used to identify the drug. The testimony was, I entered these numbers into the pill identifier, and the pill identifier indicated that those numbers were consistent with the numbers that appear on Percocet and Xanax. So there was not a confirmatory identification in this case.
Now I'm confused. Then how were they identified? It was a drugs.com website. You looked at the website, oh, it looks like those pills, so they must be those kind of pills.
Correct, that's the conclusion he drew, but the testimony was not that these pills are Percocet and Xanax. The testimony was the numbers on these pills match the numbers found on Percocet and Xanax.
Okay, so the testimony was, as counsel says, these appear to be
correct.
Certain things. How is that in any way sufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? Don't you have to prove the pills, in fact, are the controlled substances, not that they appear to be?
I think given the totality of the evidence in this case, the evidence was sufficient for a finding beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant told the trooper when she was pulled over that she had taken Xanax earlier in the day. She repeatedly claimed that she had prescriptions for all the pills that she had on her. As we just discussed, the pills had identifying markings that were associated with Percocet and Xanax. Although the blood test didn't reveal any levels of Xanax in her system, there was testimony that the detection levels of Xanax can fall below what's available on a blood test within 2 hours, that her blood draw occurred an hour and 59 minutes after she was pulled over. So under those circumstances, I think, given all the evidence was sufficient in this case. I'd just like to point out that the cases cited by the defendant in her argument in support of her argument concerning the hearsay are inapplicable to this case. The first case, the Anthony case, which is an unpublished case from Wisconsin, has nothing to do with hearsay rules. That was purely a sufficiency of the evidence based on the pills in that case that the defendant had were not the pills, or did, the information from drugs.com did not indicate that those pills contained a controlled substance. The second case was strictly limited to North Carolina Rule of Evidence 702. There, an expert testified that he had used a drug index called Micromedex to identify certain pills, and in that case, the court said they couldn't use that database for a confirmatory testimony that those pills were actually the controlled substances. Here, as we talked about, Trooper Hansen, that was not the testimony in this case. The testimony was these pills had markings similar to those of Percocet and Xanax.
Counsel, do you concede that the only possible theory of admissibility for this drugs.com evidence is 803.17? It's the only one I see raised anywhere. I just want to make sure that I'm right about that.
I don't know if I have a satisfactory answer for you. I think it's the best fit under these circumstances. Given the trustworthiness, it was clear that the court went through lengthy findings regarding the admissibility under that rule. The evidence presented to him concerning the trustworthiness of the information on drugs.com was significant, I think, and under those circumstances, I don't think it could have been an abuse of discretion. But his finding could not have been an abuse of discretion.
But what evidence do we have of the reliability, other than an officer saying, well, me and my fellow officers, we look at this website. The website itself disclaims the accuracy of the information on the website. It says basically, don't rely on this. I mean, just to paraphrase.
I think that disclaimer is a disclaimer you would find in pretty much anything, including books these days, just because lawyers put disclaimers on things. So I don't think that defeats the trustworthiness. Not only did Trooper Hansi testify that his office uses drugs.com, the court noted that, I think his words were, scores of judicial opinions rely on the information of drugs.com. In their opinions, not from the parties themselves, but the actual courts cite drugs.com for uses of particular medicines, side effects, et cetera. And I think that speaks to the reliability or of that website, and also to the fact that certain occupations rely on drugs.com for the information that it provides.
How do we know that? What foundation was there for that statement? That certain professions rely on that?
Well, the officer.
He didn't say that, though. He said, me and my fellow officers, we look at drugs.com. That's what he said, and that's all he said.
I think that profession would be police officers. I think that with the court statement, I think judges rely on drugs.com. I also think, you know, from the editorial policy that was part of Defense Exhibit B, drugs.com states that it achieves its goal of being entered as the most trusted source for this information by providing up-to-date information to both customers and healthcare professionals.
So if I say I'm reliable, it makes me reliable. That's what the website says. I'm reliable, and you're saying that makes it reliable.
I think that certainly helps in the findings for the court, given the other information it had, and also its business with respect to its motivation to foster reliance by being accurate. Its business necessarily depends on being accurate. Without accuracy, no one would go to the site, and it would not be a business. I think it's also important to point out that the information from the pill identifier is sourced unedited from well-known companies, and this is in the editorial policy, which is Defense Exhibit B, from well-known companies in the pharmaceutical industries whose reputations depend on being accurate. So given all of that information, I think the court made the correct finding here that it was admissible under 803.17.
Well, how do we know it was accurate? I thought you said it wasn't used for any confirmatory purpose. It was just saying that the number matches the number. How do we know that it, in fact, shows that this particular pill was what it purported to be?
How do we know? I'm sorry, how do we know that?
When you say accurate, that's how it continues to be used by the public, is that people know it's accurate. How do people know it's accurate if there's no confirmatory testing?
Just as someone generally from the public going to the website and entering a pill into the pill identifier? I guess we...
Right, but how do you know the response is, in fact, an accurate, true response? I mean, you get a response, but how do you judge the accuracy or the reliability of the response?
I think under the rule, you judge the accuracy by the reliance by the general public and by particular professions, and, as I said, the motivation of those of the companies that provide that information to foster that reliance on being accurate. If drugs.com was not accurate, courts wouldn't rely on it, wouldn't cite to it. I don't think the police would, check their computers in their cars, check pills on computers in their cars with it. I don't think.
Well, the function there is very different. They're checking at that point for probable cause. And so they can rely on information that may not be as reliable or airtight as other information. They do that all the time in all kinds of contexts. That doesn't mean that same information is sufficient to prove an element of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a different standard.
That's correct, and I think in this case we have other evidence in this case which makes the totality of the evidence sufficient.
And let's go back over what that is, because I'm a little unsure, because now you're saying this was not used to identify the drug. It was just used to make it as testimony that this particular drug appeared to be one of the charged types of drugs. Okay, not that it was, but it appeared to be. Okay, and I think you'll agree with me that to have conviction under these statutes, it's not sufficient that you prove that something appears to be a controlled substance. You must prove that it was a controlled substance. So are you saying that with that testimony coupled with the fact that she had admitted to taking a Xanax, that's enough to prove that those pills were Xanax, not just Xanax, but something else completely different?
I think her admission that she had taken a Xanax, her repeated claims that she had prescriptions for those pills, and the fact that she had said she had taken Xanax and that the pill that was one of the pills that was entered into drugs.com came back as Xanax bolsters not only the identification that those pills, the numbers matched, and the identification of the Xanax, but also the Percocet in this case. certainly the reliability of the drugs.com search engine is bolstered by that fact.
We've talked about reliability. Doesn't 803.17 also talk about necessity? And what was the necessity to use a website to identify the drugs?
I don't know if I can speak to why the police or the DA in this case found that to be the necessity. I believe there was testimony that Trooper Hansen said when he's not at the station, that is what they use to identify pills.
But there was nothing to prevent a later chemical testing of the pills, was there?
Not to my knowledge, no. With respect to the expert testimony, I think I do not think any of Trooper Hansen's testimony was expert testimony. I certainly think everything that he testified to was could have been testified to by anybody using reasoning familiar with everyday life. He testified repeatedly that he had no expertise in drug identification nor medical training, so there could not have been an aura of expertise surrounding his testimony. If there are no further questions, I'd ask this court to affirm the court below, and I reserve my 2 minutes, 39 seconds for Mr. Orman, if you'd like to speak.
Mr. Orman, if you wish to address that issue.
Actually, since there's time, if I can address the fine issue, which is what I thought I cross appeal on. I want to differentiate all of the other issues which have been discussed today from that issue, because I don't see any of the issues with the drugs.com or the purported expert testimony or really any of the issues raised in the defendant's opening brief as applying to the issue of the no proof of insurance charge. So I think that in the event this court makes any decision on the other issues, still has to make a decision on the no proof of insurance card. And at the end of the day, if this court finds that the district court erred in the fine that it imposed, we'll need to remand that to impose the legal sentence. Regarding the fine, I want to make clear that what we have here is a statutory incentive for people who get a ticket for failure to prevent proof of insurance or present proof of insurance to go out and get a compliant policy. So the legislature has essentially said, look, you can come in, show us the card, or show us a policy, and your fine can be $250 minimum instead of $500 minimum. Essentially, the legislature is creating free money because most people, it's going to cost less than $250 to get a month of insurance. So they can come into court, get some insurance, and the fine is going to be reduced. They really end up almost getting it for free. And that is the incentive, I think, that the legislature set up. The defendant's argument appears to be, well, if you don't own a car, you never have to come in and show proof of insurance. You can't go buy insurance on a car you don't have. Well, lots of people go around driving cars that they don't own. People borrow cars. People maybe shouldn't be driving the cars. But at any rate, they're driving around cars. The cars have to be insured. And if you're stopped by an officer or you're in an accident, you have to present proof of insurance, regardless of whether you own the car. And under the theory that the defendant sets out in her reply to the cross appeal, anytime someone doesn't own the car that they are driving and fails to present proof of insurance, they would never be subject to the minimum mandatory $500 fine. You have to obtain insurance in order to get that special benefit that the legislature has created to reduce the fine below that $500 minimum mandatory. And if the court doesn't have any questions, my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Roman. Ms. Cruz, you have a little over a minute left.
Thank you. Okay, I'm not going to spend much time on the cross appeal, but I do want to clarify that the statute's not just whether you own a car, it's whether you own or intend to drive. Here, the record established Mr. Hardwood's not owning a car and wasn't driving, so I think that is a distinction under the rule.
But I do want to return to the issues in the opening brief. Just really briefly on the expert testimony issue that my opponent brought up. If indeed it is the case, as he says, that this testimony was not expert testimony, well, then it's pretty baffling why the prosecutor went to such lengths to make it appear as though it was. And I think that's really the issue in this, case, is we have constant appeals to specialized training and experience. And the point of that was to bolster the reliability of unreliable evidence, to basically mask its unreliability in front of the jury to convince them that this is some special thing here. We've got this special website that officers use. And so I think that's the issue. And I wanted to just briefly address the drugs.com evidence, you know, in Anthony MS, which defense counsel cited to the court, so that was before the court. They found that it was insufficient evidence because it was so unreliable. And in State v. Ward, they actually held under their version of Shrek that visual identification is not reliable and is not admissible in a criminal trial. So I just want to clarify those points in a certain amount of time. So I just ask that the court vacate Ms. Hart's drug convictions and not reverse and grant her a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Your arguments will be helpful to the court in the course in reaching a decision. The matter stands submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.